I'm Terry Teachout, drama critic of The Wall Street Journal.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. I write for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Village Voice.
And I'm Peter Marks, theater critic of The Washington Post. Welcome to the 13th episode of Three on the Isle. And if you're superstitious, it's the 14th episode. It's a podcast from New York about theater in America. We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of Theater Communications Group.
Today, we're really excited to welcome Jack Cummings III, artistic director of the New York-based company Transport Group. Their latest production, a revival of Tennessee Williams' Summer in Smoke, is at Classic Stage Company through May 25th.
First, though, we're going to talk about a subject that even itself for me is problematic, and the subject is problematic revivals. This is a nebulous notion, I guess, for some people, but what we're really talking about here is the problems that arise in bringing back shows from the past, many of them written by white men of another time who can't be woke because they're dead. And who but who wrote things that now feel to us in some ways antique in terms of the values that many theater goers, the audience, holds as givens. We're talking today, maybe we're focusing most specifically about two musicals that are on Broadway and that many people across the country have seen in many permutations and variations in their own towns. And those would be Rodgers and Hammerstein's 1945 musical Carousel and Lerner and Lowe's 1956 musical My Fair Lady, both of which are top contenders for Best Musical Revival for the Tonys coming up very soon. And also both have, in some surprising ways, been very well received by the New York critics.
Yes, they have gotten some of the best reviews of the spring, actually. And actually, to this list, I would like to add another revival that has not been included in the whole problematic show discussion, and that revival is Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh. And there was only one review that I've read that really brought up what the play itself says, and that was a review by Sarah Holdren in New York Magazine, and she wrote that, quote, "The show hangs its entire emotional arc on the violence done to two women by men who claim to love them and are in fact driven by festering hatred." You don't often see that take on The Iceman Cometh. It's actually one that I pretty much agree with. I find this play unbearable, no matter how well done it can get, and I've seen it done very, very well,
right,
as we all have. So I would like to include that among the other two.
I guess also, Terry, I want to hear what you think. But, you know, when we talk about the problematic aspects of Carousel and My Fair Lady, which may not be that apparent to some listeners, but we're really speaking about the feminist aspects of the show, or the anti-feminist aspects, if you will, what happens to Julie Jordan and to Eliza Doolittle in these pieces may seem in terms of issues like violence against women and the sort of servile aspect of how women are treated by men in past times feel to some audiences, and particularly to women, as if they're no longer really relevant. But Terry, do you consider these problem musicals? Is that a fair way to think about these beloved pieces of work?
I don't like the term. And I don't really like the concept. The shows exist. They're important works from the past. They are classics. You can make a case for saying that if you don't like them, don't do them. If you're going to do them, how should you do them? Increasingly, people are saying, well, we'll rewrite them, as was the case with the last Broadway production of Porgy and Bess, in which the book was radically rewritten. Or you can restage them in a way that alters the meaning of the work itself, which is exactly what happened with My Fair Lady, where the last scene was restaged in a way that is consistent with Pygmalion, the source material, but not with My Fair Lady, the musical. And the whole idea of saying, all right, it's problematic, to me, that's a, it's like a warning sticker that you're putting on shows, or a rating, like a kind of an ideological condom. You must put this on in order to engage with the show. And I just, you know, Carousel is what it is. And what it is a show about a woman who falls in love with a man of very questionable background and morals. And he dies violently as a result of his behavior. The woman loves him anyway. Is this a kind of experience from which we should be sheltered? I grew up thinking that theater was something that was supposed to make you, among other things, uncomfortable, that was supposed to challenge your ideas about the world. And instead, more and more, what people seem to want to do is to be sheltered from uncomfortable ideas about the world just because they think they're wrong.
Well, I think there's a different... I think there's that, but there's also shows that, to me, unquestionably are... have ideas and themes that are kind of, I'm just going to say, they're just not cool anymore. we don't think that way anymore. And that's okay not to do them anymore. A lot of the shows in the Encores series, which resurrects flop or short-lived musicals for very short runs, most of them, the books have been trimmed. Last week, they did Me and My Girl. They cut some lines from some of the songs that would not fly anymore today. I don't really have a problem with that. I think a couple of lines also have been cut from Carousel in the current revival. I don't have a problem with that because I think the spirit and the integrity of the show are respected.
That's the test, isn't it, Elizabeth?
It's at the same time, we could argue about, okay, what is the integrity of the show? Can we still have that? Must it be respected? It's so tricky. Part of me, as you know, I'm very much in favor of director's theater, and I'm like, okay, just go at it. But I'm also always torn because I want to see it the way it was, especially with Encores. I want to be brought back to 1952 or 1926, warts and all, and I realize that some people do not want that at all.
I have a daughter, who I've taken to the theater since she was, you know, little, and been very liberal about what she sees. She saw Rent when she was like 11 years old. I had no problem with that. Really, she was always very. We talk about the contexts and things before, and what she got, and what she didn't. But I was.
They know a lot more than we did when we were there.
But I don't do a Bechdel test, but sometimes I do a Lizzie test. She's grown up now, but I think back to that, and I think of which shows I would take to her and what I'd have to explain to her. And I went to a production of The Pajama Game in Washington fairly recently, which is so sexist and so artificially sets up these man-woman things. And there's a scene at the very beginning of the show where the foreman, who's the hero, the John Raitt character, says to the young woman, Babe, who is the well-named, I guess, lead female character, and she works for him, and he says, hey, you know, you're the cutest dish of a complaint department I've ever come across. And I was like cringing at the idea because, you know, we are living now in a post-Me Too world where we're conscious of these things. And I think to myself, you know, what is the responsibility of a theater company in this situation? Do they just roll it out for parents to decide whether or not this is something they might want to explain to a child, that this is not the way people talk to each other in the modern days? Or, you know, what is it saying about all of us when these shows are presented as if nothing has changed?
Well, let's take for an example something that's not a musical, The Boys in the Band, which is about to be revived on Broadway.
Right.
A show which, when it first opened off Broadway in what was it, 68, I think it was.
Yes,
was taken to be a staggering revelation of the way gay men lived now, and then not so many years later, and for a very long time afterward, was regarded as unmentionable as a document of self-hating gay men.
Right.
And now it's being revived on Broadway, and I think with damn good reason, because it is a very good play, but it's also a play that does show us the way that gay men lived and felt back then. You know, ought we not to be exposed to that? If the play has its own honesty and integrity, to use the phrase that Elizabeth used.
And to go back to the line about Babe from the pajama game, like, I don't think I would have a problem seeing that. To me, the show is clearly a period piece. We are in a different mindset. Like, if I sit to watch the pajama game, I know very well.
Right.
When it was written, what was going on then? And I don't expect the wokeness of...
Yes, but you're a much more informed theater goer than most of the people going to see it. And I would also say that the difference between plays and musicals is, for the most part, especially the musicals we're talking about, you know, before musical drama. I mean, there are musical dramas in that period, no doubt about it, and very important ones. But the seductive aspect of music and the kinds of songs that were sort of, you know, become popular were in that era, the popular music of the time wrapped around these stories had it led to a different set of expectations about what kind of story we were going to hear, that it was treated in very lighthearted ways. Even the most difficult kind of subjects were softened, you know, were cushioned by the gorgeousness. I mean, there is no score that's more beautiful than Carousel. I think it may be the most beautiful score ever written. If not, it's one of the five most beautiful scores. And yet the story, you know, in some ways is a real counterpoint to the gorgeousness of the music, as we learn basically that, and in fact, you know, if I went back and read Lilium, the play in which it's based by Molnar, which really intensified the violence. I mean, there were references to beatings all through that show, but still, there's a, you know, we're still couching it somehow in beauty. You know, that's the kind of the wrapping around which we're telling a story about the harshness of a male of a batterer. And a woman who tolerates it. I mean, and who lets him off the hook, essentially, for it.
Well, I think we had alluded to that in another podcast. And to me, the show never condones Billy's behavior. It's a very complicated show about someone who stays in a bad situation. The show does not condone that situation.
But is it really about that, or is it about a man? I mean, it seems to me that we're giving a lot of credit to Julie's journey when it's really not the focus of the musical. She almost disappears in the second act.
She does, and I see what you mean about the second act bringing Billy's story. But I still don't see that as a, well, you could say it's a redemptive move, and that could be a problem. But I have a hard time explaining, actually, and rationalizing why I don't have a problem with that. And I think it circles back to the beauty of it. And a lot of people object to the second act being a mess versus a pretty much perfect first act. But I have to say, I get so swept up in it, in the sheer aesthetic beauty and, oh my God, so many things, unforgivable things have been done, you know, in the name of aesthetic beauty, that is very, very dangerous terrain there. But when I saw it, I remember thinking, this is such a tragedy of epic grandiosity, of a kind that American plays often do not reach for. And that's what they were trying to go for, some epic tragedy, not just a drama or melodrama. It was an epic tragedy. And whether you think they pulled it off or not, okay, we can argue about that. But to me, it works. And I was completely, completely swept up in it.
I think, too, that Carousel is a show whose problems, if you see them as problems, are amenable to being solved through staging, through the production. You don't have to rewrite the show. You can change its emphases through the presentation. I'd say that the other musical that has been mentioned in this connection, My Fair Lady, is one in which the problems, if you want to call them that again, are really baked into the show. As most of us have experienced the show, which is the film, it is a substantially older man, a woman who presents as being extremely young, a very tricky sort of relationship that ends ultimately in her submission to him, her acceptance that she wants to have a romantic relationship with him. This is what bothers people. I think it probably didn't bother people as much in the 50s because Rex Harrison was a lot younger. And it also didn't bother people as much because Rex Harrison was an extraordinarily charismatic performer.
Mm.
You bought the idea that the younger woman might fall in love with him. I found it hard to buy in this production because I did not find the person playing Higgins to be at all charismatic.
Haddon Payton? What's his name?
I think it's Haddon Payton.
Haddon Payton? Yeah.
Because I think it's meant to kind of think of ham and bacon when you pronounce Haddon Payton.
So you didn't find him compelling.
Yeah, but they solved the problem by casting Higgins young, or they think they solved the problem by casting him young and by staging the end to. There are different ways to interpret the way the end of that staging meant, but my reading of it was that she is not going to go with him. And
let's just say they didn't change a word of dialogue.
No, not a word. No. Not a word. But that's not My Fair Lady. My Fair Lady is a musical version of Pygmalion with a happy ending, if you think it's happy that Eliza ends up with Professor
Higgins. I had absolutely no problem with the ending in the current revival. I thought it was a very smart, very elegant way to, and purely a directing idea, a directing decision to do it that way. With people always say, oh, the directors, they messed with the text. Well, no, they didn't. The text is there. It's a director who had a very strong point of view on how to do that. And for me, it was just like problem solved. I cannot watch the movie. I find it unbearable.
Say why.
Oh, my God. What a horrible movie. I just can't stand it.
Oscar winning.
I adored that revival. I was so happy. I had a huge grin on my face and like all 3 hours of it.
I would say I actually liked Harry Haddon Payton because I thought they went not only young but immature, and I thought that you got the sense that this guy had not grown up yet, and it really comes home when she sings Without You. That is revelatory, I think, for the two of them. And Lauren Ambrose, I thought, for me, was a lovely presence and believable as someone gaining strength. And also, I will say, the other thing I will say is, you know, if we're talking about directors getting to show us how these musicals can remain vibrant and pertinent, why not let them reinterpret the ending if it doesn't damage the integrity of the script? And also, in fact, is arguably closer to what Pygmalion is at the end. So, although I know Terry's going to say,
yeah,
it's not, you know, My Fair Lady is not Pygmalion, right?
Well, it's because My Fair Lady is a musical and it has a score, and the score is telling us something also, not just the words, but the song, the whole situation is telling us that it's going to work. It's going to be a happy ending.
I think you're right.
Yeah, I'm not averse to the idea of staging a show in a way that, so to speak, contradicts its plain meaning. but it's got to land correctly. It's got to work. And it's awfully hard to stage a musical where the music is sending an extremely clear emotional signal about what's going on, as happens in My Fair Lady.
Can we just talk briefly about Iceman 2? Because I brought it up, Elizabeth.
Yes.
I was very disappointed with the production myself. Terry, where did you come down? And address Elizabeth's what she brings up in Sarah Holgren's review in New York Magazine about the central idea here being the violence committed off stage against women we don't see. One we do see, but one we don't see.
Right.
And the women in the show are the only women in the show, by the way, are whores.
And the climactic monologue by Hickey, of course.
Right, is the description of his.
Right.
Yeah, anyway, but what was your take, Terry?
I just didn't. How is that problematic? I mean, this is a guy. Listen to me. That's not what I mean, Elizabeth. This is a guy who does something horrible and goes to hell for it, essentially. I mean, he's doomed. He has committed a frightful act, and the frightfulness of the act is because of his own, in part, and the play, I think, makes this very clear, his own illusions about humanity, about women, his false ideas about them. It seems to me that the play, when interpreted correctly, disposes of these problems quite effectively. I mean, I saw what Sarah was talking about in her review, but I just don't feel it. I mean, how much worse could what happens to Hickey be, honestly?
I am not feeling that sense of the doom befalling him in the current production, which is directed by George Wolfe on Broadway.
Right, that's the current production. That's
or even the previous one that in which Nathan Lane
I didn't see that one.
Hickey.
I saw the one with Kevin
but
Spacey
I,
years
I felt
ago.
The same. I've never felt that Hickey. I just don't feel like, you know, I saw the current revival the same week. It was a pure coincidence, of course. I saw it the same week that guy in Toronto, I think, rammed into people in his van. Mm. And this is when we all learned, well, not all, well, the wonderful world of incels, involuntary celibates, became a kind of mainstream revelation. And so the same week I see Iceman Cometh, and I'm thinking, Hickey is like this guy. Mm. I hate myself. But I'm not going to deal with it myself. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you, the woman. And I felt that was so repellent in so many ways. And admittedly, the show, the play, really captures that self-loathing. But at the same time, I just wonder why the play is never analyzed in terms of this avalanche of self-pity from this man who spent 4 hours, that this would be considered a classic is unbelievable to me. And it's never questioned that this would be a classic when you could easily argue it's as violently negative as My Fair Lady or Carousel. But why is it never brought up in those terms? That's why it surprises me. And admittedly, the fact that I saw it that particular week really brought it home to me. I felt this is what's going on in this play. This is 4 hours of drunks. And I've got to say, the romance of the barfly has always eluded me. I'm not a Bukowski fan. I just don't buy into that romance of, you know, the drunk at the bar, the wisdom.
Well,
of the
just
drunk.
Yeah. Scott Rudin's the 4 hours of drunks. Vincent Vitatelli.
Listen,
New York.
The romance of the barfly.
There are times when I'm seeing a Long Day's Journey into Night, and I just want to run up on stage and slap the characters around.
I just saw
and
it.
Say, you know, get some therapy. It's maddening that they can't break through to any greater.
Get out of that freaking bar! Just leave that bar.
Well, you know, but that was O'Neill had steeped himself in Freud and was deeply interested in psychological sort of parsing of these four people, obviously his family.
Well, okay, I think our feelings about Denzel Washington may have varied, but however you feel about him, however you felt about Nathan Lane in the previous revival, I think that if you do not pick up on the fact that Hickey is a doomed man who seeks oblivion, and that he's come to a place where everybody is seeking oblivion, then the play itself is not landing correctly. It's not being done right.
Well, oh, no, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, as we wrap up this discussion or start to, what you're both saying interests me. Elizabeth, does this all mean that this is the fact that we're so heatedly discussing these plays mean we should be seeing them over and over again? Or does it mean, maybe they should be put on the shelf because new work should replace these?
I've got to say, personally, this is one of my pet peeves. Okay, so Denzel Washington decides, okay, I'm going to do Hickey, and he has the power, basically at this point, to be like, fine, we'll, this is my understanding, is that fine, we'll build a revival Last Man Comments, because, and now we hear that Denzel Washington, may want to do King Lear next, to which I say, please don't. Because one, we do not need another King Lear. Two, Denzel Washington has such power and influence, please let him, like, champion a new writer. Why isn't he championing the new August Wilson or the new whoever instead of doing yet another King Lear? Use your power for good, not another revival. It is safe. So, and but let's not forget, he's the most praised actor of his generation per his Playbill bio.
Right, that's in the program.
Lear is a play that everybody does, in fact, do. I think I counted it up 2 years ago. And I think I'd reviewed it 16 times in the last decade and a half. Iceman doesn't get done that often. And I think it's fair to say that if Denzel Washington can cause it to be done on Broadway with George C. Wolfe as the director, then at least in theory, that's a good thing. That's good for theater. Lear, I don't need to see anybody's Lear for a while. And honest to God, I don't need to see anybody's Long Day's Journey for a while either. Everybody does that because it's got one set and a small cast.
But would you guys attend happily another Carousel in My Fair Lady?
Not next season.
Is problematic mean, set aside?
No, I think the new revivals to me show that these musicals can be done. Mm. Why should we deprive ourselves from these scores? It does boil down to an aesthetic judgment there.
I think that's true.
Well, they seem to have satisfied the most of the people who find the shows problematic, as far as I can tell.
I've got to say also, I am really not in general a Rodgers and Hammerstein fan, but I was told.
Speaking of, Terry has a really interesting essay about Rodgers and Hammerstein in Commentary.
Yeah, I wrote a long piece about Oscar Hammerstein, who is not... We went through a very long period when he was regarded as a kind of a joke. And now people are beginning to see, no, he's in fact one of America's most important dramatists and deserves to be taken quite seriously. And at least a discussion like this means that he is being taken seriously, that the show is being taken seriously. And since we have now taken it quite seriously for a few minutes, maybe it's time to move away from the problematic aspects of theater and into something which is not even slightly problematic, the career of a very important director and the leader of a great company.
It's a real pleasure to welcome Jack Cummings III of Transport Group, a New York company whose work I've long admired. Citizen's first production, which was Our Town in 2002, the company has established a strong identity with a well-balanced mix of premieres and revivals, plays and musicals. Revivals have included The Boys in the Band, which was done in a Chelsea loft, David Greenspan's solo version of Eugene O'Neill's Strange Interlude, very, very long Strange Interlude, a revival of John Van Druten's I Remember Mama, with an all-female cast of actresses in their 60s and older, I believe. Even 70s and older, 80s and older, just really incredible. Way up there. And premieres, I've included Michael John Lacusa's Queen of the Mist, which is a personal favorite, I've got to say. Lysistrata Jones, which actually transferred to Broadway. And the 200 musical, The Memory Show. I thought we would just start at the beginning and board the hot tub time machine. And Jack, could you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got that crazy idea to start a theater company?
Sure. Background. Let's see. I grew up in Virginia. I went to William & Mary undergrad and got my graduate degree at the University of Virginia, MFA in directing. And I met my wife.
In what field?
Directing.
Directing, okay.
Yeah. And the summer before I graduated, I met my wife, Barbara Walsh. I was Julie Boyd's assistant at the first season of Barrington Stage Company. I learned a lot from her, and I kind of owe my marriage to Julie. She introduced us. And I finished my last year at UVA and then moved up here in the winter, spring of 96.
And the Barbara Walsh?
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, a friend of mine from graduate school, Robin Hussa, an actress who now lives in South Carolina, she and I had this production of Our Town that I had envisioned, in which George and Emily were played by two actors in their 60s at the time, Tom Ligon and Barbara Andres, and the stage manager was a 12-year-old girl. And the idea being that it would kind of intellectually or emotionally come together in the third act when Emily goes back for her 12th birthday. So that was our very first production. And we had just wanted to do a production of it. And we met together at the Applejack Diner and said, if we're going to go to all...
Many a thing, right? Has happened at the Applejack Diner.
Applejack was our password forever on everything. But we just decided we were very passionate about that play and that version of it, so to speak. And so we just decided, well, if we're going to go to all this trouble, maybe we should think about starting a company. And so that's what we did. And Robin was with the company as my co-founder and partner until 2006. And now I have an amazing, incredible executive director named Lori Feynman, who's been with me for the last 11 years. So the two of us are our partners in this endeavor.
Now, I did not see that version of Our Town, but where was it staged? Because you have a...
You're homeless.
Right, we are homeless. We did the first many seasons at the Connolly Theater on East 4th Street.
I love that space.
Okay.
And I discovered that space for myself. I was looking for me, what would be the perfect space for that production of Our Town. And when I saw a friend show there and thought, oh, this is where we need to do this production of Our Town. And then we ended up staying for about 7 years.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, you started because you wanted to do this show. But obviously you've evolved into an ongoing operation, and one that I would say has a pretty distinctive aesthetic. I mean, would you talk to us a bit about what you understand, this sounds pompous, but you'll know what I mean, what you understand your mission statement to be, your aesthetic mission statement?
Sure. I think at the time, I mean, this kind of is all the time, it feels like there's a, you know, there's always the British invasion happening, you know, in New York. All for the better. I'm going to be diplomatic. But no, I just felt like...
You don't have to be.
I think we were also trying to find something that would give us a perspective and a definition and an identity that wouldn't be so narrow that there would be no room to breathe, you know. So Rob and I talked about it, and I just felt very passionate about American work and American authors and really, you know, the American identity. The American Experience on PBS is probably one of my favorite shows. American Masters, all those shows on PBS I just love. And I'm just continually curious about who we are and kind of how we got here. And so I hope that the pieces we do in at least to me, shed some light, you know, on that.
I was just speaking just the other day to Eric Tucker of Bedlam and another company in a similar situation to yours, started up later than yours. But it seems to me that companies like Transport Group, Bedlam, Fiasco, all sort of have emerged in sort of the same time frame, and all with the purpose of reinvestigating, in large part, works we've seen before in ways that are, you're saying to us, you know, we need to see them newly. Do you think it's a coincidence that this is happening, that these kinds of companies have all grown up off-Broadway at the same moment? And then found audiences, a very, you know, avid audiences?
You know, I'm not sure. I have found I'm 50 now, so I started the company when I was, 33, I guess?
Oh, so you've been around longer than I have.
Yeah, we've officially, like, incorporated or did all the paperwork in the fall of 2001, and then our town was in the winter 2002. I have found that as I personally have aged, I'm more curious going back. Whether it's things in my childhood, or I've been rewatching episodes of All in the Family recently, because I'm like, I remember this as a kid, but I didn't quite understand it. Now I'm more curious to know what were we going through and so forth. So I think personally for me, I'm always curious to go back and try to understand something that as a younger person I didn't maybe understand.
So I just wanted to ask you, Jack, for our listeners who have not seen your work, we're not in New York. I think one of the things about the Transport Group is that it's got a very strong aesthetic and style. Could you tell us a little bit about, could you describe it for us?
Oh, you know, I don't, you know, it's, I'll try.
Although you may
you
not
might
agree
be able to describe
that,
it better, because I don't feel, I mean, I know what things are important to me, but I feel like, someone, like the current production of Summer and Smoke, we're not using props. And someone asked me the other night at a talk back, oh, do you always work without props? And I said, oh my God, no. I said, you know, and the boys in the band, we had not only had props, we had set dressing.
I remember.
And for Come Back Little Sheba, it was all about the props. It really is kind of play specific. Mm-hmm. And I think when we did the boys in the band in the apartment and we did Hello Again in a Soho loft, I think people started to think that we just did things in non-theater spaces, but it's really only twice. And I guess Judson Memorial Church, which I love that place, the gym there, you know, that is, it is a theater, but it's a big room as well. And so, but we've really kind of been all over the place with the aesthetic. Once Upon a Mattress was a,
oh my God,
in
yes,
some
of
ways,
course.
A very, like a traditional, you know, we had an orchestra pit and a curtain that went up and down. and so to me, just for me personally, I should say, it just really depends on the piece at hand. And I think, you know, this will go for any theater person, you know, director or company. You know, to me, it is the two most important things in the end are the words of the writer and the actor. And then everything else with the design and everything around it is really just, it's all pointing that those are the two children, and we're just pointing all back to them. So that's what's personally important to me. But I think most artists would say that in the theater.
Yeah, I think maybe if we talk for a moment about the Inge works that you did in repertory, that might help to make clear what your work looks and feels like. Because you did two different plays by William Inge in alternating repertory in the same space at Judson. But the sets looked radically different and the approaches were radically different. Would you tell us a bit about your thinking there?
Sure. Well, I love space and I love design. And to me, having the right designers and that collaboration is equally as important as the collaboration with the leading actor and with the writer. It's and on the some moments when I am hired outside of Transport Group, what normally the people find out right away is how picky and how stubborn I can be on the designers that I want to work with, you know, which I think sometimes people don't. I've just gotten puzzled looks sometimes. I'm like, why are you insisting on this particular designer? And I did a world premiere of an incredible Terrence McNally play, And Away We Go, at the Pearl Theater in 2013, and had a remarkable time on it. And I remember we were getting down to finalizing the details, and I was insisting on my sound designer, Michael Raspberry, and there was, you know, just pushback for nothing personal, but there was pushback. And I just said, well, it's either me and Michael or I can't do this. And Terrence stood behind me, you know. But
good for
and
you.
my friends are shocked to hear that. And I was like, the sound design for this play will be incredibly important, and I know that this is the right person to do it. And I was willing to walk away from a world premiere by one of our legendary playwrights in order to. I'd rather do it right than. I'd rather not do it at all, I should say, than not do it the way I feel about it. The Inge plays, you know, you know, we're limited in a way in that. in Judson, and that and the fact that it was repertory, that we had it had to be mobile. Dane Laffrey, my designer for those shows, believed very. We both believed in giving the audience a completely different experience. So if on a two-show day when they walked back in, hopefully they would not recognize and recognize the space at the same time. But I'm a huge, we've done a lot of William Inge plays during our time. And I felt like for him in his writing, the loneliness and the ache is so raw and so exposed. And I wanted to complement that visually as well, as much as I possibly could.
One of the things that struck me about your doing this, and I have a particular interest in Inge, I just wrote a play about him, in fact, is his work is not all that commonly done, even in regional, most certainly in New York. And it was quite a major thing for you to do two of those plays in repertory, to make such a commitment to this playwright. Would you talk a bit about the decision to do that, and again, what it means in terms of the company's mission?
Sure. I think that I think he's a very valued, important playwright, and I think very, you know, deep theater thinkers would agree. But, you know, like everything, you know, time marches on and other amazing writers come to be and, you know, things fall in and out of the canon. And so, which is the way it should be. And, you know, we need to make room for the new writers. And, you know, but I feel like when possible and when resources allow, it, and if the right people are around to revisit and to keep his work alive, I think is important. I think his voice is timeless. I think that what it says about men and women and sexuality, but for me, it really, with him, it always just comes down to someone feeling achingly alone and someone who is an underdog, in the sense that, you know, just feeling like he had no friends and no way out of, you know, the misery that is life. And he was just trying to work through it and ultimately wasn't very successful in that with his suicide, sadly. But I was that kid on the playground. I don't know if I was picked on, but I was not like front and center and, you know, like any child, you will normally feel left out. So I have a soft spot in my heart for people that I perceive to be like that. So, and he falls in that category.
Jack, I'm curious. I think my introduction to the company was Lysistrata Jones, which was, you know, really cool. And I remember writing about it and really thinking this is, you know, amazing, turning this gymnasium into this gymnasium. And wondering, though, over time, why I had a hard time locating Transport Group, in a sense, not as someone who's, you know, was participating for a while from Washington and, you know, and is more in the city now. But have you found that has Transport Group's identity been firmly established enough so that people follow you wherever you go? Or is it the title that brings people to your shows? What's the and have you learned things over this, you know, 17-year span about how to make those things happen, how to synergize, you know, the company and these titles?
That's a great question and a challenge we're always grappling with. I think that, you know, every work we do, I feel, tends to be kind of very, for better, hopefully only for better, just incredibly different from the one before it. Like, the one season we had, I devised a piece about Helen Keller based on her writings, and then the next show was Once Upon a Mattress.
Wow.
So, you know.
right.
And that's, I always say that's kind of like that's the essence of our company. You just kind of don't know what's around the corner. So I think, and we don't have a physical home. So I think it is challenging for us. And not only do we not have a physical home, we, you know, when you are up against trying to find the right venue for the right piece, which that's always important too. It's not just you want to do any piece in any venue. You want to make sure the two are simpatico. And so you were up against scheduling and when are the dates available and time of year and so forth. And so we don't have like a set schedule. We will produce within a 12-month period, but within the 12-month period, it can be anybody's guess until we know what it is. So it's definitely, I like to think that just purely through age and certain events that people are know who we are. I don't know the amounts. You know, I would love to say millions, but we do find that it just, it because the show is very so much, that it really just we always work as if we're starting over with every show, you know, as opposed to a theater with a home and subscribers and things like that. We're kind of the opposite. So it's definitely a challenge, but at the good part is it allows us to not have to adhere to any pattern.
So in the past 16 or 17 years, how do you think the landscape for like small companies has changed in terms of raising money and funding? Have you seen an evolution? Have things become easier, harder in terms of institutional support, mm-hmm. Fundraising, all this kind of nitty-gritty stuff that I think is, it seems very basic, but I think a lot of people around the country are like, how can I make this work?
Right. I have found, although we have grown and we've met more people, it's all relative. So the more you grow, the more money you need and so forth. But no, it's only gotten harder. And New York is tricky because we're one of, you know, how many nonprofits, worthy nonprofits, that are going around to either wealthy foundations or wealthy individuals and so forth. I think in the old days, back in the glory days, which somewhat precedes us, is corporate help. And what happened was, my sister, who works in marketing, explained this to me. Corporate giving used to be like just a good thing to do. You know, the business did it mostly because it was like a nice thing to do. It was the right thing to do. And then what happened was that philanthropic giving got moved over to the marketing departments. So when you are a small company like us, and I can speak for many, many small companies like us who would all say the same thing, that we don't have basically the marketing bandwidth to offer them, meaning we don't have a long run. We don't have a physical space in which to really promote something.
Or they can put their name on it.
Exactly. And the audience numbers we're reaching don't meet the marketing numbers they want to reach. So basically, philanthropic giving from a corporate point of view is really now just like bought advertising. So that more or less is gone. And every year we keep hoping we will find the one outlier in the corporate world. So if anyone in the corporate world is listening, I'd love to talk to you. So that's one thing that is super hard. And then and the foundations, although we are incredibly blessed to be receive support from many, you know, it's never enough. And they're often not taking, especially when the crisis happened, they're not taking on any, you know, new people either. And then the wealthy individual donor is tricky as well, because there are certainly, we are the beneficiary of many incredibly kind people who are giving it for the work itself, and in the goodness of their heart. But then you have another type of donor who is I don't know any names per se, but like, you know, it's much more glamorous if you want to give a wealthy gift to Lincoln Center or any of the big institutions,
or if
right?
you're building a building.
Exactly. Like there's a kind of a quid pro quo,
quid pro quo.
Yeah. So that's always a challenge, and to find the people who have those means, who can help you and want to help you for all the right reasons and the pure reasons, because all we have to offer as a company is the work. I don't necessarily have glamour to offer that person.
You seem pretty glamorous to me.
Well, it says if you wanted to build like a $20 million building, you could raise that money, but for operating budgets, it feels like it's become so hard.
Oh yeah, owning your own building and own thing is a different. Yeah, I would not jump into that lightly. That's a very, it solves many things and gives you other problems.
I'm not saying you should, but it seems like I think there's like, it's become completely insane. The money that's been going into buildings, and then mm-hmm. well, how do you pay for the budgets, but that, I think that's for another podcast. Operating budget podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
not having a home obviously has, it's conditioned what you do and how you do it. And I get the impression that it might even be sort of baked into the aesthetic itself. Would you want to have a permanent home if the opportunity arose?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, I will say it is every year, it is a nightmare trying to figure out where to go and when you can get your dates and when and what you can afford. I mean, nightmare from every possible angle. However, having the right show in the right space and not and having that flexibility is tremendous, and I feel I would not have wanted to do Once Upon a Mattress anywhere else. You know,
then
I wanted
Abrons. It was at Abrons.
Yeah, Abrons Art Center, which is magnificent. I would not have wanted to do Strange Interlude anywhere else but Irondale Art Center in Brooklyn. So it's you know, it's both. It's good and bad.
So what at this point? What's a dream project for you right now, Jack? What do you, if you're thinking big for the next ones?
I know.
What do you want to do?
I will say my dream project is I would love to do the Kentucky Cycle.
Hmm.
Whoa.
Yeah. I was in graduate school, and we all went up to D.C. to see it before it moved here, and changed my life.
Hmm.
Yeah, changed my life.
Some of our younger listeners might not know what you're talking about.
The Kentucky Cycle by Robert Schenken. It's a how many parts is it? I'm going to say nine.
Five or six, I think.
No, it's more. It's a two act. You know, it's a two part. Meaning, there's a part one and a part two, like, you know, Angels in America, and it won the Pulitzer Prize. You know,
and it never gets done.
Yeah, it's nine parts.
Nine parts.
Warner Shook, the original director, did a phenomenal job, and the acting company led by Stacey Keach, an incredible company of actors. I had never seen anything like that before, and it just, the traveling through time and just the questions it was asking, I still vividly remember so much of it, and I've always wanted to bring it back here in some way, shape, or form.
I may be wrong, but I've never seen it, but didn't come out like around the same time as Angels in America? And I think
it did. It would have been in it would have been in the 93-94 season. I think I saw it in the fall of 93
right
in DC.
Right.
Yeah, right on top of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Would you consider condensing it the way Michael Wilson did Horton Foote's Orphan's Home Cycle?
Condensing,
do you think that's even feasible?
Did he cut it? When you say condensing, you mean he
Yeah, I mean, he Michael, you know, transformed that into a shorter production unit.
I have to say, I am not one of these people who tends to cut, especially something legendary. You know, I know people, certain directors have no problem doing that, but I loved the. I'm not afraid of length, clearly, and we didn't cut a word of Strange Interlude. And I know normally it is cut, and I understand why it's normally cut, but we didn't. We weren't in that situation, and we wanted to do every word. Didn't cut a word of Summer and Smoke. I've never done that. You know, if I'm working on a new play where it's in flux, yes, you're adding and cutting and adding and cutting. I've never done it on an old play. I wouldn't dare.
I don't know. He might be grateful for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, if obviously he's alive, and if he wanted to revisit it, then that's another story.
And has Schenken seen it again? Is it done?
I feel like, you know, I'm sure smaller. I think there have been other productions. Yeah, there hasn't been a New York production.
Right.
But yeah, yeah.
And what's your next? What's the next show?
Next up for us is, I'm very excited. It's a new musical about the early life of Edna St. Vincent Millay, called Renaissance. That is culminates with that poem, the poem that brought her fame and attention. And the music, the lyrics are her poems. And Carmel Dean, an incredible composer, former musical director who's now working full-time as a composer. This will be her debut, and we're very excited about that. And Dick Scanlon is writing the book, and he and I are co-directing, which we've done a workshop and are having a great time on it. And that will be at Abrons in the fall. Michael Starobin is doing the orchestrations. And so, yeah, we're very, very excited.
And Summer and Smoke runs through?
Friday, May 25th, a week from today.
Let's not get away without letting you tell us a bit about Summer and Smoke itself.
So it's our first co-production. John Doyle at Classic Stage, who's a friend of mine, approached us, and he wanted to expand the company into doing American classics as well, and thought it would be a good partnership. And he suggested the title. I had done a lot of Williams before I moved to New York, so it was really the only other title I wanted to do of his. And we did a reading of it with Marin Ireland for their subscribers a year and a half ago, and decided to do it, and it's just been a tremendous experience, you know, to work on his writing on any, like Inge, on to work with those words has really been kind of a dream come true for all of us. And so it's just been a truly great experience. And Michael John Lacusa wrote a beautiful score for it, and a great company, Marin, Nathan Darrow, an incredible company of actors. So we've had a really, really great time, and we're going to continue the partnership with Classic Stage.
Oh, that's really good news.
Yeah.
That's very good news.
Yeah.
Very exciting. Well, listen, thank you, Jack.
Thank
Jack
you,
Cummings
guys.
Jack Cummings III was our guest. Thank you for spending some time with us about one of Off-Broadway's most interesting companies.
Oh, thank you.
So we're going to turn now to one of our traditional topics on the 13th or 14th podcast. Of Three on the Isle, and that's the point at which we talk about the shows recently that we either really liked or really didn't like, and we wanted to point those out. And I guess I'll start. I just came back from Washington, where I saw a terrific revival, I guess you'd say, of Bedlam's initial production of St. Joan, which is a four-person version that was first done in 2012. This company is now at the Folger Theater in Washington. I had just seen the Broadway version with 19 actors. This one with four actors was more compelling, more entertaining, more disputatious in a good way. And I would say that part of the reason that I found that was because the director, Eric Tucker, who's done many, obviously directed many of those, his productions, he's the artistic director, really worked with these actors to figure out who each of these people were. And when you're, although an actress named Drea Brown played Joan, the other three actors found so many ways to define this pantheon of characters, this gallery of men of the 15th century, that it really nailed for me all the issues that Shaw so tartly and smartly raises in this piece.
I saw the original run of that production off Broadway, and I said then, I thought it was the greatest Shaw revival I'd ever seen. Mm. And I, nearly a decade later, I still feel that way.
Good for you. And what do you, Terry, what about you?
Well, the thing I've maybe enjoyed the most in the last couple of weeks that I've seen was the American premiere of Alan Ayckbourn's latest play, which is called A Brief History of Women. Every couple of years, Ayckbourn brings one of his productions over to 59 East 59th Theaters, the Off-Broadway house, for their what they call their Brits Off-Broadway Festival. And he brings his own staging of a play or plays of his, done by the original cast, modified, because he always does them in the round over in England, and they have to be done differently over here. But you still get a chance to see a very important English playwright who is also an extraordinarily accomplished director show you how his work should be done. And not all of them are out of the top drawer. A Brief History of Women is, I think, not one of Ayckbourn's very best plays, but it's a good, solid play. It's a play with four scenes that all take place on the ground floor of the same country house in England at 20-year intervals, with one character who is the continuing character. It's almost like a mini-series compressed into the span of 2.5 hours. And it's a lovely play. It's touching. It's very funny. With Ayckbourn, you always have an element of farce. But it's also staged with this amazing, practical, simple economy of a guy who knows how to put his shows on stage. And it is his 81st play. How is this possible? Ayckbourn is from some other species, superior to our own, I think.
Elizabeth?
My pick is a new play by a young playwright named Claire Baron. It's called Dance Nation. And it's just been extended again. Keeps being extended at the Playwrights Horizon. I think it's one of the hits of the spring here in New York. It won the 2017 Susan Smith Blackburn Prize.
Oh, it did?
And interestingly, it shared the 2016 Relentless Award, which was funded by the Philip Zimmer Hoffman estate. And it shared that award last year with The Wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And the two shows actually have quite a bit in common. Destination is also about a group of girls. In this case, they're younger than in The Wolves. They're maybe 12, they're supposed to be 12, 13. They're played by women in ages range from the 20s to the 60s. And it's very, very funny, but also quite often brutal and surreal play. And I was going to say it's going to be produced everywhere. It's not as accessible as The Wolves. It's got a much darker underbelly. It's a wonderful, wonderful play. And I cannot wait to see what Claire Baron is going to do next. It's a very exciting show.
Do you think it could have a commercial run, Elizabeth? Could it go to Broadway? Is that a kind of show?
If The Wolves can't do it, I don't think this one. This one, as I say, is a more perverse and surreal and darker. It also has nudity. It's definitely not for, I would say, yes, by all means, bring a young teenager to The Wolves. This one, I'm not so sure.
I'd say in that other universe that Alan Ayckbourn lives in, they could probably bring it to Brooklyn.
Yes, right. In Bizarro World, it's going on Bizarro Broadway.
Not in this one.
And I think we've run out the clock. My God, that was an action-packed podcast today. We're going to wrap things up. As always, I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
I'm Terry Teachout.
And I'm Peter Marks. You've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is Kirby Pate. You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle and write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com. And both cases are spelled out.
Make sure you leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or Google Play.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on the Isle.